Today, why there's been a rise in anti-Asian hate crime in the US.
You see these videos pop up on social media and they play out over again and again. And you ask, are we under attack?
Vivian Ho is a Guardian reporter based in California. You might have seen the videos she's talking about while scrolling through Instagram or Twitter. Videos of Asian Americans being spat on, verbally harassed, and in some cases, physically assaulted.
Seen this before? You're right. It's just the latest in a string of attacks against Asian Americans.
A string of violent attacks against elderly Asian Americans has law enforcement on alert.
Evidence shows that attacks like these have been on the rise since the pandemic began.
The level of violence is just repeated on you and you're exhausted and it's awful. It's one of those things that the Black community has experienced with all the videos of Black men and Black women being shot by police officers and being brutalized by police officers in the past decade. And it does something to you psychologically. You start wondering, you know, do I belong here anymore? Do they think I belong here? And that's sort of the existential question that happens for every Asian American.
One advocacy group in the US has received thousands of reports from Asian Americans who say they've been harassed since March 2020. And in the first week of his presidency, Joe Biden signed an executive order directing federal agencies to combat xenophobia.
Particularly against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders that we've seen skyrocket during this pandemic. This is unacceptable and it's un-American.
Now a protest movement is spreading across the world, from the US to countries including the UK, where there's also been an increase in anti-Asian violence. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how the Stop Asian Hate movement is forcing the US to reckon with a racism it has overlooked for decades. Before we start, I just wanted to let you know that we will be discussing acts of violence and racial slurs in this episode that some may find troubling. We're going to use the term Asian American in this episode, and I wondered if you could just clarify who that refers to in the US for our audience who don't live in the country.
Well, Asian American, I mean, that's a term, you know, that's the thing. Asian American covers Chinese Americans, it covers Japanese Americans, it covers Taiwanese Americans like myself, Indian Americans, Pakistani Americans. Oh my goodness, it's so many people. And the thing is, you know, people say Asian American, they expect it to be, you know, like this blank nameless group. But the fact is, it's, you know, we're not a monolith. There's so many different groups within this group.
In the last few weeks, there have been lots of posts about violence against Asians shared on social media. What was the first video you saw?
I think the first video that really went viral was the video of the 91-year-old who was shoved in Chinatown in Oakland.
We have some new video tonight of an elderly man who was pushed to the ground in Oakland's Chinatown.
You see a man striding into the frame and just shoving an elderly man to the ground. Just very, very violently, very, very abruptly, the elderly man goes flying and just hits the sidewalk so hard. And this video just went viral so quickly. It was just one of those situations where you felt it grip your heart, where you felt watching that elderly man fall to the ground. I saw my grandfather. And the subsequent videos that kept coming out, I thought about my parents who would hate if I ever categorized them as elderly, but they're getting up there in their years. And I'm wondering if somebody came up to them and shoved them incredibly hard, what would happen to them?
The man in the video that Vivian is talking about has been named in court documents as Gilbert Diaz. He isn't Asian American, but he was attacked while he was walking through Chinatown in San Francisco's Bay Area. The man who has been charged for this attack also pushed two other elderly people in the area that day, according to police.
We do recognize that some in our community come specifically to Chinatown to target people. We know that. We know that they target our elderly.
Other videos began to emerge, and one that's really shocked people showed an 84-year-old man called Visha Ratanapakdi being violently pushed to the ground in San Francisco. What do we know about him?
He came to San Francisco to help care for his grandchildren, and he was a loving grandfather. He was dying to go back to Thailand, and he was so close to getting back to Thailand. He just got his first vaccine. He was just out for his morning stroll. That was it. And he was killed for it.
You said, Vivian, that there was a huge response to this awful video on social media. I wondered, when did media outlets start picking up on it, and did that change things?
When celebrities started tweeting about it, unfortunately.
Daniel Day Kim and I decided that we needed to take action as leaders of our community to make a statement that we're not going to take this anymore.
Daniel Day Kim, Daniel Wu were offering rewards for information leading to the arrests in some of these cases. A lot of celebrities have really just come out to raise awareness about these situations.
I kind of really wanted to lend my support to Asian American designers, friends.
Silence erases our humanity. Our stories matter.
Will you stand with us?
I hear you.
Your fellow Americans, Asian Americans, to stop Asian hate.
Here's the thing. This didn't start this year. People talk about Asian attacks, and they talk about it with the pandemic. They talk about it with Donald Trump and the talk about the China virus and the Wuhan flu.
Kung flu, yeah. We have waged a fierce battle against the invisible enemy, the China virus.
Why do you keep using this? Because
it comes from China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
And yeah, that definitely added to the rhetoric. But anti-Asian hate did not start this year. Now, I feel like the community has really reached the point where people are really just saying, enough is enough. We're not going to take this anymore. We're sick of being your token Asian. We're sick of being your token minority. We're sick of being your token model minority. We're here to fight the system that hates us just as much as it hates every other minority.
Adrian DeLeon, you're an assistant professor of American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. We've just heard from Vivian about the response on social media to recent attacks, and she spoke about the model minority, which is essentially the myth that Asian Americans are successful compared to people from other minority groups because they are seen to work hard and keep their heads down. When did this idea develop in America?
It really started to take off after 1965. That is, after the supposed shift from an exclusionary system of immigration in the United States towards something that they called a merit-based inclusionary system in the United States. And this was the 1965 Immigration Act signed by Lyndon B. Johnson.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power. Yet it is still one of the most important acts of this Congress and of this administration.
1965 was at the same time the year of anti-Vietnam War protests and a year in the thick of the civil rights movement. And so one of the things that the United States did was, as a sort of response to the civil rights movement, it promoted a points-based merit, points-based system that heavily favored highly educated, middle class, and specifically from certain types of the world that included and highly favored Asia.
Okay, what was the impact of that?
You have decades and decades of disproportionately, quote unquote, economically successful Asian families in the United States who are then pit against Black and brown people in the United States for reasons such as, oh, look, these minorities are successful. Why can't you do it? And so already built into the logic of the model minority myth is a sort of anti-Black logic and a classist logic, as well as a racist logic as well.
It's clear that Asians have been facing racism in the US for a long time. How would you trace the development of that prejudice through the country's history?
Watershed moments in US history on anti-Asian violence, most people start with 1882, which is the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
On the eve of the greatest wave of immigration in American history, President Chester A. Arthur signed into law an extraordinary piece of federal legislation. It was called the Chinese Exclusion Act, singling out as never before a specific race and nationality for exclusion. It made it illegal for Chinese workers to come to America and for Chinese nationals already here ever to become citizens of the United States. It would remain in force for more than 60 years.
It instated what would set the tone for several decades until 1965, which is a quota system in American immigration. And it was a quota system that was applied to people of color around the world. At the same time that they excluded Chinese people, they started including migrants from places like Ireland, Italy, Eastern Europe, into the United States.
As Adrian says, the Chinese Exclusion Act set the tone. Throughout the 20th century, there are examples of horrific persecution of Asian Americans. In 1930, Filipino farm workers were attacked by hundreds of white farmers who thought they were taking their jobs in what became known as the Watsonville riots. And in 1942, thousands of Japanese Americans were imprisoned in internment camps.
More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast states to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places. They are not prisoners. They are not internees. They are merely dislocated people, the unwounded casualties of war.
In the 1960s, Asian Americans began to organize and protest against the hatred they experienced. And then in 1982, there was a turning point, the murder of Vincent Chin.
Vincent Chin was a Chinese American in Detroit, Michigan, who was murdered by two white men who had blamed him for the encroaching, invasive success of the Japanese automotive industry that was pushing out automotive jobs in places like Detroit, Michigan, despite the fact that he was of Chinese descent.
He slipped. Mr. Evans was standing over him with a baseball bat. He had it with both hands, and he was hitting him in the top of his head.
He swung the bat as if a baseball player was swinging for a home run, full contact, full swing.
And what had happened was, while they were charged with second-degree murder, they were able to bargain it down to manslaughter, which provoked an anti-racist outcry from Asian American organizers.
Although at the time of Vincent Chin's murder, there were some legal protections for people who'd been the victims of racially motivated attacks, advocates said they didn't go far enough. In the decades since, hate crime law has been introduced to protect minority communities. Adrian, how would you connect what we've just talked about to what has happened in the past year? Is there a thread line that links all of these moments?
Well, for me, I think, you know, with respect to both the Chin case and bringing it back to Chinese Exclusion Act, is the easy thing to do under economic crisis, under pandemic crisis, for the U.S. seems to perpetually be to blame its immigrants.
Vivian, Adrian has described a history of racism against Asian Americans that goes back more than a century. And what is clear when you look back is that this is a group that has struggled to have a very loud voice in the country, it feels like. Why do you think that is?
A lot of immigrants are afraid to speak up because, you know, out of fear of the government, fear of deportation. And we also have to keep in mind a lot of them are coming from places where if they did speak up, they would be severely punished for it. You know, I'm still learning things about the history of Asian Americans every day. One incredibly awful piece that I learned was during the Chinese Exclusion Act, where Asian women were allowed to get citizenship if they were born here, but they lost citizenship if they married Asian immigrants. Culturally, you just couldn't shake things up. Your circumstances were so tenuous that for a long time, Asian Americans kind of understood that if you kept your head down and if you worked hard and if you kept to yourself, you would be okay. And it worked out for a while. We took care of our own. We created our own system where we policed our own. When the banks wouldn't lend to us, we created lending systems to lend to each other. One of my favorite writers, Frank Chong of the LA Times, he wrote a lot about why there's such a proliferation of Cambodian donut shops in California. The reason why is because that was the only way that they could get in, by lending to each other. And that was how the system controlled an entire sector of a population and kept them from speaking out against the injustices that were brought against them.
Asian American communities across the US have had to support each other. And one way of doing that has been to form civil rights organizations. If you go to the heart of San Francisco's Chinatown, you'll find a red brick building with a black sign. And on it, painted in elegant gold letters, are the words Chinese for Affirmative Action.
Well, our organization was formed over 50 years ago, and it was formed by social workers and student activists who saw a need in the community. We had a huge influx of Chinese immigrants to the city, and they were actually inspired by the Black Civil Rights Movement.
Cynthia Che is the co-executive director of CAA. She and her team are advocates for Chinese Americans in San Francisco and beyond. They help improve access to schools and to the legal and housing systems.
As a daughter of immigrants, we certainly experienced, my parents certainly experienced hardship in terms of making ends meet, of not being able to speak English. And I have very vivid memories of my parents trying to advocate for my brother, who at that time had a learning disability, and how difficult it was to understand what was happening when you're up against an institution that hasn't responded to the needs of immigrant children, children of color. And vivid experiences of growing up in a multiracial city and then moving to predominantly white suburb and being welcomed with our home being vandalized. My parents knew at that time that it had to do with race. It had to do with the fact that we were the first Asian family on our block. And that time I didn't know what to name it, but it certainly left an impression.
At the start of 2020, as COVID-19 was spreading across the world, Cynthia and her team began to hear reports from Asian Americans who said they'd been attacked and had racial slurs thrown at them about the virus. In March last year, they started to collect reports, and working as part of a coalition called Stop AAPI Hate, they documented what Asian Americans across the US were going through. AAPI say that they have recorded thousands of incidents in the past 12 months.
What we've found is that over 90% of what we would consider verbal harassment, dehumanizing treatment, a majority are not what we would consider hate crimes, meaning there's a crime that was committed plus some racial motivation. But yet we still feel that those should be taken seriously, because without proper interventions, we certainly have seen these situations escalate.
So what you're saying is that you've had all these reports of what seem to be targeted attacks on Asian Americans, but most of them wouldn't qualify in the US legal system as being hate crimes. Why not?
Well, within the United States, we have a very clear legal framework and definition. And essentially, because speech, even hate speech, is protected by our Constitution, there has to be a crime that's committed, plus some evidence that it was motivated by hate towards that protected group.
You've worked in this field of anti-racism for many years now, and I wonder, when the pandemic began, if you could have foreseen that this would have been one of the results of it, you know, this huge level of anti-Asian feeling within America and other countries too.
Gosh, even with, you know, a deep understanding of our history, that we would be blamed for the pandemic. I do remember receiving our first hate mail about it, and I can almost recite it verbatim, which basically said, "You Chinese, of course you're responsible for bringing this deadly virus to the United States because you eat bats and pangolins." And I remember receiving that, sharing it with my colleagues as we were preparing to, you know, close our offices and figure out how we were going to continue to serve our community during this time.
I'm receiving that letter, Cynthia, and I mean, it sounds awful. How has that, and how has cataloguing these attacks over the last year made you feel?
You never get used to it, and I hope I never will. It's really important that I continue to talk with impacted people to make sure that their stories are lifted up, because it's very traumatizing. And as a parent, you know, of three daughters, the stories that stick out for me are parents who reported that their children were verbally harassed or bullied, and talked about not wanting to be Asian, feeling the effects of, you know, internalized racism. Those are the things that I think about.
Coming up, Vivian reflects on the prejudice she has faced and whether this could be a moment for change. Vivian, what impact did the Black Lives Matter movement have for Asian Americans last year?
The racial reckoning that happened over the summer made everyone consider the role they had within the system. And it made everyone realize just how entrenched the issue of white supremacy was. When people used to say white supremacy, I used to picture the KKK. That's all I thought it was. But white supremacy is just a system that puts everyone who is non-white below. You don't realize it until you actually start opening your eyes to it, just how entrenched we are in the system. And I think for Asian Americans, the racial reckoning over the summer was just very eye-opening for them in that way, to see how it happened, to see what that means if you're not white, if you're not Black, but you're still a minority.
And in the past few weeks, you've spoken to organizers from both Asian and African American communities. And something they're concerned about is that the response to these attacks could cause divisions, because some of the suspects are Black men and some Asian Americans have responded with stereotypes of their own.
This is where it gets really tricky, and this is where it gets really difficult. And this is where the system of white supremacy rears its ugly head once again. We're in a system that pits communities of color against each other. And what a lot of people are unwilling to talk about is that these attacks are plucking at some longstanding racial divisions between the Black community and the Asian community. It's so uncomfortable and it's so awful to have this conversation. But what's basically happening right now is that we have a lot of very intellectual and very progressive activists and protesters and advocates advocating for communities working together where nobody is being attacked, where there's no more hate. But we're also having an Asian community that is traumatized. And some members have a long memory of these racial divisions between the Black community and the Asian community. And these racial divisions go back a long way. The fact is, you know, like, because of white supremacy, Black people were redlined into poorer neighborhoods. Poor Asian immigrants were forced into those neighborhoods. It became a battle for scarce resources, for scarce housing. And then racial tensions came up from there. You know, you want to move forward to this beautiful, bright future that you're envisioning. But at the same time, how do you explain to your popo and your gonggong that they're being racist and that anti-Asianness is also rooted in anti-Blackness, and that this moment about anti-Asian hate is also a moment about anti-Black hate? Because you can't talk about racism in the United States without talking about anti-Blackness, period. Where this issue is really coming to a head is the issue of policing. The victims and a lot of the older members of Chinatown and the neighborhoods, they want more police. And that's always been kind of the knee-jerk reaction. Whenever there's an uptick in crime, people want more police. But if we learned anything from the protests over the summer, from George Floyd, is that more police don't mean we're safer. You know, there's documented evidence that police shoot and kill Black and brown people at higher rates than other community members. And so what's the solution? And that's where it gets hard.
We've talked about very blatant attacks against Asian Americans over the past year, attacks that have been caught on camera, and that's why we're all talking about them tragically. But is the reality that the racism you experience is much less overt and something that is talked about much less?
Oh, yeah. That's the worst part, isn't it? The racism you experience that you can't quite put your finger on. It's when you walk into a barbecue place in a small town in Oklahoma and everyone goes quiet and looks at you. It's when the guy at the bar is just a little bit too creepy and starts listing all the Asian women he's ever dated. It's death by a thousand paper cuts, right? It's a little cut that just marks your heart.
How does it feel for you watching a lot of people talk about this at the moment and thinking back on everything we've said? Do you think that this does feel like a moment of potential change?
It does feel like a moment of change. And I think the calls to work together with other communities, this is the right direction to go in. We need to get everybody involved and realize that this is everybody's fight.
Vivian, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Vivian Ho. She's done some fantastic reporting on this story, including an article she wrote with Abenay Clayton called Black and Asian Unity: Attacks on Elders Spark Reckoning with Racism's Roots. Find it at theguardian.com. In relation to the attack on Visha Ratanapakdi, a 19-year-old man called Antoine Watson has been arrested and charged with murder and elder abuse. He has pleaded not guilty, but his lawyer says that his client had an outburst of rage. He has not been charged with a hate crime. Thanks to Vivian, Adrian De Leon and Cynthia Che for speaking to me today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.